our next presenter, we're excited to have him here in Texas. He is the owner of a business, a company called Start Nine, and they help people to onboard into the decentralized technology space. Let's give it up for David Croissant, ladies and gentlemen, of Start Nine.
How's everybody doing? I know you just ate lunch. It's a little slow. I'm feeling a little slow. If we could get this slideshow up on there, and there it is. See, ask and ye shall receive. I wanted to give a quick thank you to everybody behind this curtain right here, everybody in the kitchen. Let's give it up for these guys because they're sweating, they're stressing, and they're really putting on a really powerful professional event here. And I'm really impressed with the work that's gone into this and how it's going right now. Just a quick piece of errata. I am not the owner or CEO of Star Nine Labs. I've been there for a couple of years, but the company's been around for 3 years. I'm actually not going to talk too much about Start Nine today, but I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. So I'm going to talk today about responsibility, liberty, and technology. And just quickly who I am. My name is David Croissant. I've been working with open source technology for quite a while now, about 15 years. And currently I'm working with Start Nine Labs to help people declare their digital interdependence. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what that means. And I'm going to sprinkle in a little bit of, you know, we're in Texas, so I want to sprinkle in a little bit of founding fathers here. Be it remembered, however, that liberty must at all hazards be supported. We have a right to it derived from our maker. But if we had not, our fathers have earned and bought it for us at the expense of their ease, their estates, their pleasure, and their blood. So this is to say freedom isn't free, right? Something in the people in this audience surely understand. Let me get a, who's familiar with these guys? Let me get a quick show of hands. Who uses any of these guys' services? My hand is up, you'll see. Almost everybody. There might be a few hands. Let's leave those hands up for a second. How many of you have grievances? Leave your hands up with any of these guys. I didn't see a hand go down. Let's leave them up. One more last question. How many of you read the terms of service when you agreed to use these services? I see a few. That's impressive. I see 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe. That's a lot. The most I've ever seen in a room is one. And that was Erin from Float. Some of you guys know her. So let's go on to the next slide here. There's only really one reason that we do this, right? And that's complacency. And I'm talking to myself here too, so don't feel offended. This is me, this is all of us. We're all the same at the end of the day. But the reason we do this is because these are seen as free, even though realistically we're not, these are not free services, right? Who's the product? We're the product, that's right. Safety, that was a big one the last couple of years, huh? Lack of attention to the consequences of using these services. So what are we trading for these free services? We're trading data that can be used to understand our buying habits, our political affiliations, potentially, you know, our movements, geolocation, things of that nature. And most importantly, and what Start Nine's working on is that we're also surrendering to these companies and these institutions our digital property. So imagine you take a picture, and whether or not you believe property is real, if a picture that you take is belonging to anybody, it belongs to that person that creates it. And we're very quick to blast through these terms of service without reading them, give this property up to some third party, such as Google. And then every time we want to use that property or we want to share it out with our friends and family, we have to go and ask permission. We have to log in, right? Can I have my digital property? Can I access that? And can I share it to my friends and family? So I think we all understand the problem, and that's about as much time as I'm going to spend on the problem. I want to talk about solutions. But if you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle. So if your enemy knows more than you do about yourself, and they do in many cases, this information war is not going too well. I think we're finally waking up and we're figuring out the tools and how to use them, but it's not been going well for the past decade. So responsibility, how many people have heard this word broken down this way? A few, okay. So if you think about it, we've got some first responders here, some firemen. They've got their gear, they keep it maintained and orderly. They're ready to go. They are sacrificing their time, their energy for a cause that they believe in and sacrifice to others. And this is what responsibility is all about, in my opinion. And it kind of starts with the care enough to act in the first place. And the important thing about having the care to act and to act is that you start where you are with what you have, right? So if you're like me and you've been on a computer most of your life and you understand the tools, then maybe there's some more advanced things that you need to learn. And maybe it's time that you hand those tools off to other people and you help other people get further down the journey. If you look at a computer and you're like, I just want to shut the lid because it's just all spinny rainbows to me, you know, right? Then you got to start where you are and you got to understand, okay, what can I do with where I'm at to improve my situation? And so kind of two quick things that I'll recommend that folks do. One is to use an ad blocker. uBlock Origin is one, and I'll put all this stuff up at the end. And the other is to use a password manager. So those two things, an ad blocker is going to help preserve your time and attention. You're not going to get distracted by all this nonsense all over the screen, all these advertisements that are stealing your attention from you and your energy. And a password manager is going to be like, that's your safe. That's keeping your property, your passwords, your ability to log into things safe. And one other thing that's good to think about is if you're, you know, a lot of us have been on the internet and we see an article, a video, something, and we look at it, we're like, wow, that's really powerful. And that's probably going to disappear in a week, right? Like we're starting to see stuff just fall off the internet as fast as it's coming up. If you have that thought and it's important content to you, save it, bring it down off the internet and put it on your computer so that you can share it with other people when it disappears, so that you can put it onto other websites. If you have the ability, or if you have an account, a blog, a social media, put that content up and share it with other people. And liberty. So to me, liberty is the mastery of the self in order to serve others with that mastery. And a requirement of liberty is constant vigilance or discipline to that, because we know there's always someone looking to infringe on our rights and take what we have and steal our time and attention and use it for their own will. And the thing that binds all this together is love. And it's truly incredible to be in a room of this many people that I know love and care about each other, and that know so much about so many different disciplines. You know, I'm learning things about, you know, how to put some potatoes, water, and salt in a bucket of water. And suddenly my soil is actually going to grow food, which for the last couple of years I've been watching it like, oh, come on, like, okay, I got a couple of carrots and that's exciting, but I'd like to eat for longer, you know, off my garden. So it's really encouraging to be in a group like this and see all that. And I'm going to probably blast through some of these kind of quickly, but technology is just the science of craft. So any kind of tool, everything from a pencil to a supercomputer is technology. All tools are technology. And all technology is neutral until it's used with some intent, right? So you can write a book with a pencil, or you can stab it into someone's neck, and they're both, you know, there's some woes, some like, whoa, you'd use a pencil as a weapon? That's bizarre, right? That is bizarre, right? We would think of that as bizarre. That's not what that's for. But that doesn't mean that someone can't use it that way, and some people will think about using it that way for their own gain, unfortunately. Open source. How many people have heard the term open source or have any familiarity with it? Most of the room. That's impressive. Very cool. I just like to equate open source with recipes. So recipes are for food. Open source recipes are for code. So if you bake a cake, for example, and there's different, you write down the instructions, the ingredients, and how to prepare them, and then you can pass that around, and other people can change, make edits, you know, add a little sugar, take away some sugar, add some salt, whatever, to their liking, and they can share that. And then some people might collate a bunch of those into a cookbook, and they might sell that as a business. Code's exactly the same way. Code's available to view, use, and modify if it's open source. And it's typically considered free as in freedom, but maybe not free as in free beer. As I said, the recipe cookbook example, you might make a business out of some open source code. And it's generally considered more secure because since the code is completely available, other developers can look at that code and they can read through it and understand and say, okay, there might be some problems here. You might want to address that. And so the community works together on these projects to help keep them secure and operating smoothly. So the current paradigm as far as computing and how the internet works, I forgot I threw this one in here. We have against us timid men who prefer the calm of despotism to the tempestuous sea of liberty. And to that end, I want to talk about the client-server model. This is the way that the internet generally works today. And it's pretty simple. At the top there of that picture, you've got a server, and that's just a computer. All these devices are just computers. And a server is just where data is stored. So data lives on servers. Unfortunately, right now, most of the servers are owned by those big tech companies that we visited earlier. I like to call them GovCorp because they're kind of, you know, intertwined between the government and corporations in Silicon Valley. They mostly own those servers, and then they are selling and weaponizing that data for their own gain, you know, whether that's with ill intent or whether they just are looking to make a buck. I'll leave that up to you. And so this is what we know as the cloud. So the cloud just means someone else's computer is the best way to think about that. So your and your family's data is being voluntarily handed over to these big tech oligarchs, essentially. And we have created this dynamic. We've created this hierarchy, as it were. And we call these in the industry trusted third parties. And Nick Szabo once said, trusted third parties are security holes. And it makes sense, right? You're giving all your power, all your property to these people. And then they are not selling it back to you. Well, they are selling it back to you in exchange for all of your data, your metadata, your an understanding of you and how you operate. So the next paradigm, probably a lot of people have seen this one too. Can I see a show of hands who's familiar with this graph? Okay, not as many people. Okay, I'll run through it quickly. So this was actually originally produced by AT&T, I think it was Bell Labs at the time. And the idea is that on the far left is what's known as a centralized model, and many of you have heard this terminology before, where you have sort of a single node or maybe just a few, and all the other nodes, and you can think of those as computers, as people, you could think of this as a city. There's lots of things that you could apply this to. They all have to interact through one or very few centralized nodes. When you start moving to the right of this diagram, you get into decentralized, which means there's many points of centralization, which is kind of like, you think of this as like cryptocurrencies and things like that are starting to get this direction. And on the far right is a distributed model or peer-to-peer. And the idea is that perhaps everyone in this room would be connected to everyone else in this room. And there's some inefficiencies in that. So it's kind of an idealistic sort of a model. But the idea is that we want to move from the left generally towards the right in order to have more connections with each other. That keeps us more stable, more integrated, and more interdependent. So that brings about this idea of self-hosting. I think that term's a little kind of redundant, but it's becoming popular. I like the term DIY hosting or do-it-yourself hosting. So this is we still have a client-server model, so we don't have to change our devices or how things work. But instead of big tech owning a server, then you own your own server. Consequently, you own your digital property, your digital life, and all the metadata that's associated with it. You're not going to advertise to yourself. You're not going to censor yourself. You're not going to pull your content off of your server, unless you choose to. So each their own. The trade-off here is that data safety and resilience is your responsibility, right? So the biggest thing of this is keep a password safe. And if you have a password manager, it's just one password because you can store all your other passwords and they can be very long and complex and you don't have to commit them to memory. And minimal external trust is required though, so you get the benefits of being autonomous and resilient. Problem is that this is hard, right? Running a server for the past 20 years has been very possible, but it requires, you know, guys like myself look like this and they're hanging out in front of 20 terminals and they're changing config files and they're understanding how all these different programs interact and operate. And there's a lot of maintenance until now. But I want to do a quick flashback and explain why I think this is the case. So I believe this is the ENIAC. This entire room in this picture is a computer. And this computer was pretty much just used for calculating ICBM routes so that they could calculate the arc of a missile. So the only people that were really allowed to use it was the military. Cost millions and millions of dollars. Those are $20, $21. And as you can see, there's several experts in there that were required for operation. You know they're experts because they have on ties and dresses and things of that nature. What do we have today? If you play your cards right, you might be able to get a free laptop, right? There's a lot of these hanging around now that are still very operational. They're exponentially more powerful, less expensive, and basic operation of these devices can be learned very quickly. In under an hour, you can teach someone. And there's actually a really cool experiment where some guys took, they took and created a computer kiosk that was kind of weatherproof, and they just stuck it in the middle of this village in India that had no electricity and put a, slapped a solar panel on it. And the villagers were kind of looking at this thing, and they're like, oh, that's it's kind of weird. This box, screen on it, they didn't really. And the adults kind of just walked by this thing, and they were like, this, some silly Westerners just plopping this thing down in our village. But the kids started to go up, and they started to touch the buttons and see what it did. And they started to figure it out and learn. And these kids, there'd be like 10, 20 of them gathered around this one computer and learning how to use it. And then it, they started to tell their parents, you know, well, this thing actually is a really cool tool. And they started to teach their parents how to use it. So that's also, it's also really exciting to see the younger generations get their hands on things that maybe the older generations are ignoring. So I've been making this prediction for a little while, and I want to continue making it, so hopefully it comes true. But this picture here is a data center. This is, you could consider this as what the internet kind of looks like in real life. This one I think belongs to Google, but I'm not sure. So these are highly centralized. They require tons and tons of power. They're actually built based on how much power they consume. So a lot of times building out power generation is a part of building out a data center. And again, several experts are required for their operation 24 hours a day because they have very, very high uptime. I think we're now moving into an era of personal servers. So same thing as we saw before, owner-operated. These serve much smaller, whether individual, completely personal, or whether it's for a small community, a church, Freedom Cell, what have you. And these can be as cheap as nothing. You can find old computers you know, that need to be repurposed, and you can just put the correct software on them and turn them into a server. And again, basic operation can be learned in under an hour with some of the new software that's out today, including some of the stuff that Start9 works on. And the point I'm getting at here is that we can rebuild the internet into an owner-operated model, one that serves us, made by us. Complete sovereignty over your local network, which means everything that's in your home, your office, that's all segregated from the broader network. The internet just means interconnected networks, right? So each house is a network, and it can choose to contact other networks. Right now, we do all this through ISPs, Comcast, cable companies. You know, there's pros and cons to that. Centralization has some efficiencies as well, but we don't have to use them if we don't want to. We can start connecting around them. And an example of this would be like a block level, meaning like a city block. If you're regional, then you might consider point-to-point or point-to-multipoint wireless technology so that you can connect your community if you're spread in a more rural area. And when we build things in this way, then centralized infrastructure is required less and less. And what centralized infrastructure we do want to use, such as, for example, someone that's taken the time and effort to drag fiber optic cables under the ocean, we probably don't all want to do that, right? So we may depend on these companies, but they will become accountable to us because they'll be a lot closer in relationship because they'll understand, okay, these guys all have their own networks. They don't actually need a contact across the sea. But if they choose one, then we'll have to be competitive and be fair and provide a good service. And so the model that we have now, just to reiterate, GovCorp is essentially holding on to all of your data, all your digital property. And in the new model, you might consider Uncle Jim or Aunt Sarah, who might be your cool techie family member. This could be a brother, sister, friend, could be a family member, could be someone at your church in your community, someone that understands how these things work. You might sponsor them to put together a server, to put together a chat server so that if Telegram one day decides that certain content is unacceptable, it doesn't matter because you can still talk to each other, right? Because the truth is, all might be free if they valued freedom and defended it as they ought. I want to thank you very much for your kind attention. And right on. Okay. Yeah. Right. I want to throw up some resources here. You might want to just snap a picture or something. These are some very basic websites that might help you to understand some of the alternatives that we have already. unfortunately, 30 minutes is just not enough to really dive into all these solutions. So I wanted to throw them up here, and I'm here all day today and tomorrow. I'm happy to answer all your questions, and I think I can take a couple right now as well.
I'll wait for the mic. And can you get us the text from this so we can share it in our Telegram channel?
Of course, yeah.
So I'm curious, is the Raspberry Pi one of the optional measures for doing your own?
Yeah, of course. So a Raspberry Pi, for anyone that's not familiar, is a deck of cards sized computer. It's very small. It has plenty enough power to run several different server-side applications. So you could run a chat server, you could run your own suite so that you don't have to use Google, you can store your photos, your files, all things like that, of that nature. So yeah, a Raspberry Pi is a perfect way to get started. They're very inexpensive, especially if you find one used. And Start9, actually, that's the platform that we began on. So yeah, definitely. You have them.
What network? AT&T, some, like, what company for internet?
Yeah, so ISPs are, they're kind of the final boss battle as far as the internet is concerned, right? So we can take our data back is the first thing that I want to recommend. But when it comes to ISPs and connectivity, if you're continuing to use them, which is the easiest way to use the internet right now, then I would suggest that at least considering a VPN or Tor, I2P. There's other networks that you can use that at least shield your traffic from these companies and these institutions. And then what we're building towards and what we want to help people to build themselves, because we don't want to do it as a company. What we want to help people build is their own networks so that they can connect to each other and so that they don't need these ISPs anymore.
Awesome. Okay. I believe there's a question in Mexico. If you will pull up Mexico, I think they have a question. Great job explaining some complex stuff really simply, so I really appreciate that.
I'm in the audience, John. Do we have a question over here? I thought I saw a hand go up. Did you have a question, sir? If you could come over here. I'm not on the stage, but I'm in the audience. Even though you can't see me, I'm out here, John. I'm getting this audience question. We have a young woman coming here to ask a question.
Wanted to ask him to show those resources again?
We'd like to see those resources again, David, if you don't mind.
Yeah, and I'll, I don't think my presentation's up there anymore, but I will put them in the Telegram chat for folks to see.
Y'all mind throwing that presentation? Oh, did you close it? It's closed. We're going to put it in the Telegram channel for everybody, because those were some awesome links there.
And everybody can find his links and website on his speaker page on our website as well.
The great.
Any other questions here in Mexico? Yeah. All right. I got another question, John. One second. I'm running.
Dun-dun-dun. Dun-dun-dun.
All right.
Well, first, I was into networking before they had the internet, when they used to have nets in buildings and stuff like that. So it's interesting to think about going back to that. But what is the protocol that you would use if you did something like within your house? And then the protocol that you would use to connect to someone other's private house protocol.
It's a great question. So every home, every service connection that has a router is creating a network. So that LAN network, everything within that is private until you choose to make a connection outbound or inbound. And so that network already is fairly private. So we use two networks for the server devices that we sell for our server operating system. And one is that local network. So anything that you want to do that you don't really have any need to send out of your home, so like your documents and things that you want to just keep local, those can all stay on that LAN network. And then for our remote connections, right now the network that we use is Tor, and we chose that because it does NAT hole punching. I'm going to get a little nerdy here. It does NAT hole punching, so you can get in and out of that without needing an IP address, and it essentially operates as a VPN. That's end-to-end encrypted. So we use that for remote connections currently, and we're going to be adding throughout the course of this year several other networking options, including a more traditional style of VPN for accessing your own devices on your home network, as well as considering options like I2P. And then when we start talking about routing amongst each other, then we're probably going to be more interested in mesh style protocols like Reticulum, Yggdrasil, things of that nature. So there's a ton of open source projects that are working on this. It's a space that's really starting to build up some steam. So, you know, it's hard to say exactly what we will be using in the next 6 to 12 months because there's so many options and everything's changing so quickly.
I have a question. When we talk to people about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, a lot of people say they'll just shut down the internet. So can you answer that? Can they shut down the internet? And if that is possible, which I think it's pretty impractical, but if that were to be possible, what can we do about it?
Yeah, so it's the same as saying, like, can they turn off the electrical grid? Like, sure, you know, and it's going to be a lot easier to do in sections, right? It's going to be easier to attack an electrical substation and shut down some area of power, some region, than it is to shut down the entire globe's electricity, because some of that stuff is just, it's segregated and it operates in different ways. And the internet's very similar, right? So the short answer is, like, yeah, sure, maybe there's a way to turn off all connectivity around the globe. But in response to that, what do? Well, we start at home. Well, we have our data, okay? So we don't have to be concerned that all of our data belongs to Google on some data center that we don't even know where it is. We don't even know what state it's in. We can actually know that it's there, and we can share it out amongst our friends. We can print documents and pictures, and we can you know, get screens and show each other video content, things of that nature. So that's the first thing, is when you own all that stuff, you don't have to worry so much about external forces, right? Because you have that ability to respond, to have all your own stuff. And then furthermore, usually that question gets asked about things like Tor in particular, right? So can they take down Tor? Like, yeah, maybe, but they got to shut down all of Tor. And guess who else uses Tor? Spooks, government. These people need to hide too, and they need to hide in plain sight amongst us, right? So they actually use these networks as well. And if Tor, let's say they turn Tor off, all right, well, we got other options. We got I2P, we've got IPFS we can use to address content and share out that way. So there's always going to be, it's like a hydra. If they do cut a head off of one of these protocols or one of these networks, then we'll just form another network. And those networks can start at your home, they can start at your community, and, you know, maybe run an Ethernet cable to your neighbor's house. Now suddenly you two are talking, and they can run one to their neighbor's house. And now the three of you have a network. That's an internet. That's all that is.
And we'll go to another question here in Texas. And I can't overemphasize, folks, do not let fear of some unknown prevent you from taking action. Because what if they do this? What if they do that? What if they get me with this? What if they just act? And the more of us that act, it makes it more hard for them to actually do some of that stuff, right? We have a question here, Brad, if you'll run the mic.
So if you keep your own server in your house, what about like disaster recovery when your house burns down? You're kind of screwed. Right?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's several options. It's the same thing as like, well, what if you keep a gold ingot in your house, right? Like, and you know, someone can find your safe and it's like, oh, well, they've got everything that was in that safe. It's a little bit similar, but the benefit in the digital world is that we can copy everything, right? So you can copy to a physical hard drive and you can take that hard drive and you can bury it in the mountains if you want to. Slap some GPS on it and that, you know, commit them to memory, whatever it is that you want to do, that's an option. Some features that we're going to be building out on our side, on the systems that we build, will include the ability to make your backups to a remote system, say a friend. We like to call it like a backup buddy, right? So you might have someone that you trust, and even though you trust them, you're giving them encrypted data that you have the password to, right? So you can make that backup to a friend. You can make that backup. You might even make that backup to one of these existing services because it's convenient. And you don't mind trusting them with that data because it's a backup. You have the original copy and it's encrypted with your encryption, not theirs. So, you know, you can trust it and that they can't read it. Right. So, in fact, we like to say at Start9 that currently the only good use of some of these cloud services is encrypted backups, because you don't have to trust them and because they have all this space that we can utilize until we make them obsolete, which is the end goal.
Okay. Any other questions? I'm going to add something. If you don't mind. Give it up for David. I think he's, I always am just, yeah, give it up for David. David, yeah. I have an immense appreciation for people that can take complex topics and make them very simple. And I think you did a really good job with your presentation doing that. You covered a lot of bases, and I hope it provides some hope and optimism for people. And I just want to echo, when it comes to Bitcoin, they'll just shut the internet down, yada, yada, yada. There's over like 35 or 40,000 different Bitcoin nodes. Is that accurate?
Well, we don't know how many Bitcoin nodes there are because a lot of them are private and they're on the Tor network. And we actually offer the ability to run a Bitcoin node. The way our system works is you can run any kind of server-side software essentially with a one-click install the way that you're used to on a smartphone with an app store. And so one of those things, if you want to run a Bitcoin node, you go to the store and you find Bitcoin, you click install, and it's going to download. And when you hit start, it's going to start syncing the blockchain. And you're going to have an entire copy of that public ledger that everybody is trusting to write their transactions to. And you can choose, hey, I don't want to broadcast, right, that I'm running a Bitcoin node. I'm going to keep this just a private node for myself so that I can be my own bank, so that I can verify my transactions and those that I make with my friends and businesses I want to interact with. But we don't actually know exactly how many there are. There are tens of thousands, though, for sure.
So, like David, I believe, correctly pointed out, if they were to shut down the internet or the grid were to go down, it would be isolated unless some aliens come in and drop an EMP on the entire globe, in which case you probably don't care how many Satoshis you have in your wallet. You're in a lot of trouble, as are we all. But if the grid were to go down in Texas, because Texas has this terrible, terrible ERCOT grid, or if they were to shut down the internet with this particular provider, because the Bitcoin blockchain is stored on 10, 20, 30, 50, 60, 70,000 different computers all across the world in just about every single country, the information that shows you own that Bitcoin will remain on all those other computers. And once the internet or the power comes back in your neck of the woods, you have access to that cryptocurrency Bitcoin once again. So we're trying to just eliminate all the freaking objections anybody might have in their head so they go ahead and get onboarded and they're prepared for the CBDC nonsense that's coming down the pike. Yes, we have another question there.
I'd love to get your opinion on the safest way to do research online. I have this weird thing called paranoia that somebody's watching me. I would like to feel a little bit more secure when I'm doing my research on, you know, whatever the hell's going on. Do you have a specific subset of tools that you use when you're doing research?
So the sort of the go-to is the search engine, right? So if you want to enter a quick query and get the best that you can about that. And so for a long time we had basically Google. They were the first. I remember when they brought out the first search engine, it was like, whoa, this thing is incredible. Like, you know, like we were using these tools called web crawlers and things of that nature. And Google really revolutionized that. But now we're fortunate that there are lots of other search engines as well. Pros and cons to each of them. There's a service that we recently added to our system called SERX. That's S-E-A-R-X. And that's kind of a meta search engine. So it allows you to, gives you a big list of all the search engines that it indexes or that it can potentially index. And you can go through and you can choose which one. So you say, well, I don't really want Google for these searches. And I do want Quant or Brave Search or, there's so many of them right now, I couldn't even tell you. But I would advise you to kind of try a few of them and just see which ones that you like, or use SERX where you can search a bunch of them at once. Research-wise, that's a deep hole. You might want to go and hop onto, man, it's hard to even direct people because when you start going into like alternative networks like Tor and I2P, you kind of have to like find the places to find things in order to navigate those networks. And I think that's maybe why they call it like the dark web or the deep web, because it's just so vast and it's just not really mapped very well, right? So the unfortunate thing is like we're drowning in data and what we're looking for is the signal, like you're saying. And it's really hard to find that sometimes. So I would encourage you to kind of just look around, keep asking people online. Join communities that kind of have gone further down that path and might have some suggestions for you. I hate to not leave you with anything more than that, but SERX is a good place to start because they have so many engines to choose from. Say it again. VPN. So I do. There's several ways. A VPN just stands for a virtual private network, right? So this is mostly used for web browsing these days. So you might pay a company for access to their servers such that you can create an encrypted link between your device and their server. before exiting into the broader internet where you're doing your search or you're visiting your website or whatever it is. That's the most commonly used. And you're sort of, you're trading some trust from your ISP, who previously could see all your traffic in the clear, to the VPN, who is seeing that traffic exit their servers. So there, you know, I do use VPNs, and I like, there's several companies that are really doing it right, like Mullvad and iVPN, who they get independent audits of their servers. So at least there's some notion that they're running what they say they are. And they use good protocols like WireGuard. But there's also ways to use a VPN without a company. So for example, you could rent server space on some cloud cloud hosted computer and form your own VPN to that computer. And they may know less about you. And all these services, VPNs, VPSs, which is virtual private server, I think, or basically cloud computer, someone else's computer. You can rent all of these things. You can pay all these subscriptions in Bitcoin, Monero, your choice. Some of them, like Mullvad, will take cash in the mail. They said they've received change before. Someone mailed them change to pay. So there's anonymous and private ways to pay for them. You can get a new account every time you want to re-up. So there's all kinds of sort of little things that you can do. But you can also create an encrypted network to yourself. So I might want to create a VPN from here to my home, so that I'm not trusting anyone, right? Because I'm only encrypting the traffic between myself and myself, such that whatever network I'm on, such as the Wi-Fi here, can't read that traffic. So VPNs are a great tool as well. And eventually, I think that the way that the internet is moving, we're going to move into using shielded networks like VPNs as a default.
Right on. Give it up for David, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a 5-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating 5 focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4, co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.